My guest today is Darlene Lancer. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist and author of Codependency for Dummies and 10 Steps to Self-Esteem, the Ultimate Guide to Stop Self-Criticism. She maintains a private practice specializing in relationship and codependency. Ms. Lancer has counseled individuals and couples and coaches internationally. She has been a consultant and workshop presenter at addiction rehabs and hospitals, and a teacher and guest speaker at colleges, universities, counseling centers, and on radio and television. So before we get into the topic of codependency, I'd like to share with my audience, I'd like my guests to share with my audience, a little bit about their background and when you were growing up, when you were a little kid, what, if you had brothers and sisters and where you grew up, and just to give us an idea of how progressed into doing what you do.
Well, I grew up with two older brothers and a younger sister in Los Angeles. What appeared to be a healthy, happy family. There was no obvious addiction or abuse going on, and education was always emphasized. I decided that I wanted to go to law school and practice law for 18 years. I was increasingly unhappy doing that, and I was in therapy, and a light went on one day out of the blue that told me, oh, the reason I became a lawyer was because my mother wanted one of my older brothers to be a lawyer.
Uh-huh.
So you can see, in terms of codependency and people-pleasing, you know, that started very early on. Mm-hmm. And I continued in that profession. And if I had had better self-esteem, I would just probably would have said, you know, this isn't working. It's not a good fit. And yet I kept trying harder and harder to fit in, and I really didn't. And then in the period of transition where I was searching and trying to decide what I wanted to do instead, it came to me. I remembered that I wanted to be a psychiatrist when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. I was reading Freud's Interpretation of Dreams when I was 12. My brother was a medical student. I was reading his medical books.
Uh-huh.
My mother really talked me out of that, and I was very influenced by her. She was very controlling and domineering. Of course, I wanted to please her because my brothers were her pride and joy. It was a very patriarchal, I wouldn't say patriarchal because my mother was the head of the family, really, but it was chauvinistic.
Uh-huh.
And that was probably typical of a lot of families in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother would say you should be a teacher or a dental hygienist or something to fall back on in case you ever get a divorce. But I wanted to show her that I had the same stuff that my brothers did. So mm-hmm. I went to law school, and eventually I found my way back to graduate school. Now it's over a couple decades, and I was just thrilled. I felt like I was taking heart vitamins, doing counseling, and it was just such a joy to me to finally be doing what I wanted to do all along.
Well, let me ask this question in the spirit of the topic today. Mm-hmm. When you reached that feeling, was your mother proud of you or did you not care?
No, along the way I realized it was really pointless to try to please someone else because mm-hmm. their opinions and their preferences come from their background, their personality. It has nothing to do with you.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I know I never did. She always said, well, I always thought your brother, I always thought he would be a good lawyer. And when I became a therapist, she said, well, you know, you can make more money practicing law.
Right.
So that wasn't the motivation for me.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, a lot of my colleagues, when I left my practice, which was very successful, I was an entertainment lawyer at a major firm in Hollywood, and they said, how did you do it? And I said, well, the first thing, you have to be willing to make less money.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I was much happier. And I had begun to work on my codependency before that, maybe 10 years before that. So it was a process of becoming who I was instead of I had totally accommodated to the relationship the man that I was with at the time. And even though I had been very independent as, at least outwardly, it's seemingly independent as a teenager and in college. When I got into a relationship, I just lost myself.
Mm-hmm.
Started giving up more and more of my autonomy.
Did you feel that you were going from your mother's house, who she was the head,
absolutely,
of, and going into a relationship similar?
Yes, yeah. Or worse, actually. But I felt that, I mean, I realize in retrospect that marriage was a way for me to leave home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was so enmeshed with my mother that to get my own apartment when I was in graduate school, I had to write a Declaration of Independence. I actually wrote a statement to her, a long page about how I was very into existentialism at the time and how I needed to be responsible for my own choices and justifying, and that I didn't mean that I didn't love her, and I was so afraid of hurting her. And I've had a lot of therapy, and I understand that she had a lot of abandonment in her childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So this was all passed on.
Kind of overcompensating.
So she was, you know, holding on to her children.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
then we were, and yet she was abandoning emotionally. Mm-hmm. And so we were, you know, afraid of abandoning her. So
what was her response to your declaration?
So she said, okay. You know, okay, she felt
sorry
for me because
her?
I was, like, crying all the time and I was, like, very depressed.
Mm-hmm.
So reluctantly, she said.
Was she surprised?
Oh, I don't, probably not. I mean, I really don't know. But
I always wonder with these relationships, you know, a lot of the times most of the time people are not open with what they really feel because they're trying to walk around on eggshells and not hurt anybody's feelings and things, that sometimes when it actually breaks and somebody just decides to do this, you know, this is not the way they want to live their life, and they start talking to the person, that sometimes it's not what they thought about it at all. You know, that's what I was wondering. Maybe she didn't even realize.
Well,
you know,
she never showed her vulnerability to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure whether she knew or, but I did say to her that I sometimes when I make decisions, I don't know whether it's because you want it or because I want it. So I was able to express my confusion about my identity. And I was 19 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I had started going to a 12-step program for a few decades and having a lot of therapy. And it's a process of
mm-hmm.
growing. And I think over the years in doing many different things, I distilled what really worked for me. I mean, I spent a number of years in therapy that wasn't helpful, that really didn't propel me on my path and becoming more autonomous and growing my self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found that self-esteem is really the bottom line
uh-huh.
for healing codependency. That and learning to be assertive, and they go together. The more assertive you are, the more it builds your self-esteem. The more self-esteem you have, the more assertive you are. And that's one
okay.
of the reasons I wrote a couple e-books about self-esteem and assertiveness.
Okay, so we got a little bit about your background and where you're coming from, which is very important, I think. A lot of the times we speak with people that some people are speaking from learning, some people, you know, from their education, some people are speaking from their experience, and some have both. And I'd like my audience and myself to know, you know, where you're coming from and why you're doing what you're doing. So that I think that was a good recap for
yes,
us.
Yes, and I understand the psychodynamics of it, too, because of my training and
mm-hmm.
seeing clients for 25 years. So that's really my specialty and my practice. And it's interesting what you say about coming from experience, because in my research for my book, I came across a number of treatises or arguments, people saying now attachment is the big thing and that it's natural to be attached. And there's a lot of people saying the codependency movement has caused divorces and has caused unhappiness and loneliness, and that people benefit from relationships. I agree mm-hmm. that people benefit from healthy relationships.
Right.
And that, mm-hmm. it, yes, indeed, it's normal to have dependency needs and to be attached. And it's clear to me that the people that are writing this don't really know what how painful codependency is.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that codependents can't benefit from the benefits, the advantages that relationship have to offer, appreciation, support, encouragement. They're in destructive relationships. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so before we go on, mm-hmm. I'd like to get to your definition, so we can have a clear definition of codependency, so when we're using that in our talk, people know exactly what the definition is.
Sure, absolutely. And all the symptoms you'll see if we discuss that derive from this core definition. And I think of codependency as someone with a lost self.
Mm-hmm.
So they're unable to access their inner cues, and so that their innate self, so that their thinking, their feelings, and their behavior revolve around another person, another a process, or a substance.
Mm-hmm.
So my definition includes addicts, too, whether it's addicted to a drug or addicted to gambling or sex addiction. But in order to deal with the underlying codependency, they have to be abstinent from that.
Mm-hmm. So let's give some, I don't know if you can use this term in the same sentence, but some simple examples of codependency in a family. And let's not talk about the addiction part of it.
Okay.
Let's talk about it without addiction first.
Well, I'll just give you an example. My own
okay.
is that when in the early part of my marriage, after my first child was born, I was very content taking my child to the park and doing things with my child on my own. And then by the time my second child was born, I wouldn't go to the park unless my husband would go with me. So I wouldn't watch a TV program unless he was going to watch it with me. I would defer to him, or if he was going to go to sleep, then I would go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So I was losing more and more of myself.
But was that a choice? And the way you looked at it was at the time, was it a choice or
yes.
something you had to do?
I had to. See,
and why? As a codependent, why do we think that we have to?
You know, I don't even think there's a thought process. I think it's just automatic.
Mm-hmm.
You just become afraid or too depressed. You can't sort of, I say, there's a chapter in my book how a sign of dependency is you lose your mojo.
Mm-hmm.
You need someone else to motivate you to go to some play or to take a trip or to start a project. A lot of times codependents will do fine if there's a structure like a class or they work in a bureaucracy or something where there's assignments. But
mm-hmm.
if they don't have a friend to do something with, they're just on their own, they just sort of fall back into depression.
Mm-hmm.
They can't seem to motivate themselves.
Well, is there a level of codependency is there a simple codependency as opposed to a complicated codependency? Is it an all or nothing thing, or how does that work?
That's a very good question. It's on a continuum, and some people, it affects all of their functioning, and some
mm-hmm.
people, it just might be in one relationship, or some of the time, and not all the time.
What do you think is the environment to have those different levels? I mean, what would be different in the environment, the other person or the other process, or is it within the person?
No, it all comes from within the person. I mean, for example, I saw one man who was head of a corporation, and he was very comfortable saying no to colleagues or customers or employees and firing people, but he could not say no to his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So it would only affect his intimate relationships. It seemed that the way that it was, the reason was because at work, he was doing it on behalf of his employer.
Mm-hmm.
So when it was just him, again, it comes to that feeling of worthiness.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes a couple have a pretty healthy relationship, but one parent will be very codependent with the child.
Uh-huh.
And it may be, have to do with their childhood, that they're trying to ameliorate what they went through, or, you know, whatever it might be, or they're parenting the same way that they were parented.
Mm-hmm.
So it may have to do with, did they have a good relationship with the opposite sex parent, with their same sex parent? It's complicated.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But then there's some people who can't, that they can't function alone, and they can't, then they're not happy in a relationship.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that the basic concept of codependency is recognizably the same across the board.
Yeah.
So the whys kind of, to me, is like addiction. You know, there's really no answers, because everybody has their own environment, how they grew up, and, you know, how they perceive things and everything. But it's the actions and the, I guess, in the present moment activities and how they react to things, which is more easily picked apart, let's say.
Well, if you go back to the definition, it's someone who's reacting to another person. Mm-hmm. Instead of responding and accessing their own feelings, their own needs, their own thoughts, they're organizing their thinking, their feelings around someone else's needs, feelings. They'll typically feel guilty if someone close to them is sad, or feel defensive if someone else is angry, even though it may not have anything to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
They feel even responsible for someone else's actions sometimes. They'll apologize for somebody else's behavior or feelings.
Oh. Okay, well, I recently, because I was curious, mm-hmm. and I like to know as much as I can about things, and I knew I was going to do this interview, I participated in my first CODA meeting, because you also talked about you had attended some 12-step meetings,
uh-huh.
And I'm assuming it was for codependency. Is that
yes.
correct? And I sat in there, and I understood that everybody in there had the same basic personalities and desires. And I could tell, and I understand this completely because I have some personal experiences in this myself, that they, within a group and support, which I always try to encourage my audience to get support for whatever they need, whether it's related to addiction or codependency or abuse or whatever, because it's very difficult to go through this stuff alone. They seem to be, in the group, more confident and have some self-esteem. But you can tell, you know, they even talked about when they left that they wouldn't be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true, and that's why support is very important, because you've come out of a dysfunctional family and possibly, probably in a dysfunctional relationship, and you're getting constantly getting reinforcement of your old behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And in the group is a healthy family, a healthy support system that's reinforcing new behavior. Now, it's very hard to change habits, even to change, you know, your diet or what time you go to bed, or aside from addictions like, you know, cigarettes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you need that positive reinforcement on a regular basis.
You know, my son was a heroin addict, and I really, after a long time, just couldn't do it by myself anymore. And I found a 12-step group for parents. And for me, the support, yes, was good, but I really went a lot because I saw that people had worse problems than I did. And I went, you know, and to me that was kind of support, because it encouraged me to know that I was not a lot different than everybody else, and some people handled it even worse than I did. So,
I remember one of the first meetings I went to, I arrived with a headache, and I was surprised it was gone when I left.
Uh-huh.
And mm-hmm. the thing that, and I never, for a long time, I never knew that I was coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't buy any literature, because I was just kind of tentative. But what inspired me the most was that I was hearing the fact that people changed.
Uh-huh.
And mm-hmm. I came in there with a belief, like many people, when they hit bottom, are hopeless.
You're
stuck. I didn't believe change was possible.
Mm-hmm.
So that really inspired me, that people changed. And, you know, and then a day came when I was encouraging by example, of newcomers because of the changes I had made.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit, because one of the main things I do this show for is for hope and the fact that people have some kind of power and control over the, you know, what they do, how they perceive things, and how they do, you know, feel about things, and not being codependent. But let's talk a little bit about how someone would, you know, they recognize this is, you know, of course you have to recognize that you are codependent, which is, I know, a big issue. A lot of people are in denial. But once they recognize that they are codependent and that it is a negative thing in their lives, how did you, how do you go about changing? Because, you know, oftentimes people are used to you being like that and, you know, get pretty comfortable with you being like that.
Well, you know, and absolutely. You have to,
and not only do you, let's say you say that self-esteem is a big thing. Well, you have, don't you feel like you need to have some pretty darn good self-esteem to even start changing the process?
Well, you know, it's a dialectical process. And first, one of the things...
Hold on a second. Would you define dialectical, please?
Well, it's interactive.
Okay.
So it's like you do... I've sort of realized that the way people change and recover is first they get to know themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, for instance, when I went to meetings, I thought I was fearless. I thought I didn't have any fears. People were talking about fear, and I didn't know what they were talking about. I wasn't afraid of, like, flying or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So then as I got more aware, I thought, oh, my God, I'm afraid to say no to someone. I was afraid to go to PTA meetings because I was so used to my role being that I was defined as my role as a lawyer or... I didn't have my sense of who I was wasn't integrated. It was like, okay, I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a lawyer. I didn't know how to interact socially.
You did what you thought was expected of you.
Exactly. So, and maybe I think my self-esteem by the time I got to a meeting had been deteriorated so much from being in this controlling relationship. So you get to know yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then it builds a little more self-esteem. And when I talk about part of that is making friends, sharing with others. I think it was very important when we called the meeting after the meeting. So I would go to coffee with people. I got a sponsor. I talked to someone on the phone. And for the longest time, she was so patient because she asked me to call her daily and just check in. And I would... each day, call in, and I would tell her how my husband was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I had no concept of myself, and then I graduated to another sponsor, and I'd say, well, what should I do? And she'd say, well, what do you want to do? And it was clueless of what I wanted. So it was like really baby steps of trying to get in touch with who I was, what I liked, what I didn't like, what I wanted. My feelings were so shut down for many years. And, okay, so then you start to know yourself. It builds a little more self-esteem. And then you take some risks. Maybe I go to a movie by myself or something like that, or whatever it might be, do something that was out of my comfort zone. Because when you're out of your comfort zone, you know you're growing. Okay, so now I have a new perception of myself that builds more self-esteem. And then I'm able to take a greater risk. And that's what I mean, like it's like a positive feedback loop, and that's instead of a negative one where my self-esteem was getting lower and lower and I was feeling more and more powerless and like a worthless victim, and then starting to feel who I was and more empowered. And by the way, I define empowerment and self-esteem in action.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you're able to take, you know, self-affirming action.
Okay, well, you were talking earlier about when you were writing your book and doing research, you were reading things about people talking about causing divorces and, you know, this kind of thing. Being, and I'm assuming you're talking about becoming empowered and regaining yourself, finding yourself sometimes – And it's true. I mean, I know a lot of people who have come through this, and, you know, there's so many people who have spent their entire marriages being codependent and all of a sudden not. And that causes, you know, they have to take the chance that this can cause some definite problems. If, you know, somebody, as I was saying before, people are used to you being like that. And, you know, they can get very comfortable in your codependence.
Yeah. I always say it's harder to reset boundaries than to set boundaries in a new relationship, because you're going to get pushback from. I remember my mother-in-law used to say, "Darlene, you've changed." "You've changed." And I said, "Yes, thank you." So I didn't, you know, buy into that and that criticism. And then at one point my mother would say, "You know, I have to watch everything I say around you." And I'm thinking to myself, "Great."
So. Okay, well, let's get into a little bit more focused on the idea of addiction and codependency. And I'm also, you know, remember here, a lot of my audience is loved ones of addicts and alcoholics. So not necessarily just the addict and the drug or substance or process, but the entire family relationship. But you were talking earlier about, you know, codependency and addiction. Addicts are, you know, addicted to drugs.
Right.
Is that a codependent relationship to the drug?
Yes, and underneath there's codependency. They often don't realize it until they get clean and sober. But,
yes, so let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay. So when the person is, I've seen a lot of people that are abstinent or they've been sober, and then they want to deal with their relationship issues because they haven't been able to be intimate in a relationship. Some have trouble even committing to a relationship. And so then that gets back to their self. And you need to have some self-esteem and a stronger sense of who you are in order to get close to someone, to not feel like you're going to be abused or exposed or lose yourself in a relationship. It takes some work and building just as a non-addict, drug addict, codependent would. You have to start building that self. And some people say with drug or alcohol addiction that the person, when they stop growing at the level they start using, so that they're, you know, they may get clean and sober, but they're still quite immature.
That arrested development aspect.
Because they have to learn how to function without the support of marijuana or alcohol or whatever it might be, and to make decisions and to be responsible and reliable and things like that. So those are the first things they learn, you know, when they're sober. And then at some point they get a little more confident that they can hold a job, that they can meet obligations. But then the issue of intimacy and relationships isn't really dealt with in AA or 12-step programs for addicts. Their focus mainly is on abstinence and sobriety.
Right. So, but also with the millions of people that are dealing this as family members, and all of us, you know, we love our addicts and alcoholics, and we love when they enter early recovery, and we all want to know things that we can do to help them, but a lot of the times, family relationships could be part of the problem.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, the family interaction, what can happen related to codependency in families to either encourage or discourage the use of drugs of an individual.
Yeah, maybe I'm sure you and perhaps some of your audience have heard of the term enabling.
Actually, on the top of my piece of paper here, the first question I have is, what is your definition of enabling?
Okay. That's when you remove the natural consequences of someone else's, you know, addiction or bad behavior or alcoholism, whatever that might be. So if the person is too hungover to go to work. You don't call the boss for them.
Mm-hmm.
You don't make excuses. I always tell people that are involved with an addict, especially like a spouse, is to have a plan B. So you're not constantly a victim of whether or not they're going to follow through on a plan, because typically they're unreliable. And then you're going to feel resentful, and you're going to be nagging them, and you give them all the power over your mood and self-esteem and everything by whether or not they're going to follow through with going on the vacation or going out to dinner or whatever it might be. So have a plan B, and the best is to go ahead without them, or you might decide to stay home and work on a project, but so that you feel like you have a choice, that you're not a victim. And in terms of enabling, this would apply to someone who's even not an addict, but not to take responsibility for someone else's behavior.
Well, let's think about, this is a question that I always hear what you're saying, and I understand that that's true, but a lot of the people that ask me when I said I stopped enabling and I, you know, I had my plan, a lot of people say to me what I used to say to other people is that, well, is it easier to enable or suffer the consequences if you don't enable? Because there's a lot of consequences sometimes.
Each case is different, but you can, it'd be like short-term pain or long-term misery.
Right.
So
that's hard to explain to somebody,
and
too.
You're going to get, you might get a tantrum from the addict that's still going to try to manipulate you to bail them out of jail, or let's say they lost their license and they driver's license and they want you to drive them all over, and instead of taking the bus and make you late. You have to figure out for you, is it a consequence that is going to make your, are you going to be financially, for instance, harmed if you don't? So there's maybe some risk involved. You have to weigh that. But to the extent that's the research has shown that that's that the alcoholic suffering the consequences of their behavior is the single most important motivation for to get sober. And that's why losing a job more than anything else is the best motivator.
People don't believe when I tell them that. My son, he's been clean for 8 years, and I did recently interview him. And that is one of the things that he said. And, of course, in my mind, because I have been around addicts and alcoholics a lot, my first reaction to him saying that, you know, why should I have gotten clean and sober? You kept giving me a good place to sleep, you know, food. You got my driver's license back when I lost, you know, all these things. Finally, you know, I had to start suffering some consequences, and it was uncomfortable. So I decided, you know, it kind of pushed me into thinking about recovery. Well, you know, a lot of people think that's a good story, but they don't think that, you know, they're worried. I mean, with addiction, they're worried that they're going to be the reason these people die.
Yes, it's very hard. And,
yes.
You know, I once heard at an AA meeting from a suicidal alcoholic, he said, if my wife had saved me one more time, I wouldn't be here today. So sometimes they have to really hit bottom. And that's why it's a spiritual program, Al-Anon, and because it often takes a lot of faith to make these changes. It's not for the weak of me.
No.
Hard. It's
absolutely not, because, you know, I can see, you know, a lot of people on the outside that aren't dealing with this and don't love somebody who impacts your life with all this drama and chaos all the time. It's easy for somebody to say, well, don't give them money. Don't, you know, don't kick them out. Do this. But this whole idea, and there's so many people dying these days of, you know, drug overdoses and alcohol poisoning and things that, you know, I guess I always say to people that they need to do what they feel is comfortable for them if they can recognize what's comfortable for them, because, you know, there is always that chance that they're going to have to live with. It's not that, you know, the idea that they're going to feel guilty that they were the reason this person died, you know, when in reality, you know, it's not their choice, it was the other person's choice. But, you know, continuously saving people is something that I see people trying to do all the time.
Yes, and there's a misconception that money is going to make the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I get contacted by people who say, well, if I just had more money, I could help my son or my spouse, but we don't really have money. It's not about money. AA is free. It's about the personal will. And
mm-hmm.
there's plenty of children of wealthy people who have died from overdose.
Absolutely.
They've been helped too much. Look at Michael Jackson, for instance.
Absolutely.
So,
and Whitney Houston.
Yeah. So it's not really about the money. And sometimes a parent, I mean, a lot of times it's just pure love, but oftentimes it's the parent's need to have that child dependent because that's their purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have an empty nest and they, you know, don't have some other, something else positive in their life to put their energy into.
You know, I see all of this and I know what I did and how I transformed over this whole experience of loving this addict, especially my son. And I remember many days waking up where I would call, he happened to be living at the house for a while, where I'd call up and he didn't answer. And I know what people feel because I felt that feeling of, is he dead or alive? I mean, that is like one of the most horrible feelings for a parent,
mm-hmm.
thinking your son is dead up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that some people have, and I have friends and people that I know that their sons were dead. And so it's really hard to speak on a logical basis, I think, with this. And I guess it is codependency, you know, probably the ultimate codependency when it comes to mother and child and something like this.
Well, I think all mothers love their child. Losing a child is the biggest loss that
mm-hmm.
Anyone can undergo. But
and you feel like you're kind of having a hand in it. It's not like they have cancer or, you know, it's something that you didn't have something to do with. And there's always that little bit of, could you have done something different?
I hear that from mothers a lot. And these are mothers that did everything,
mm-hmm.
more than anyone could imagine. And yet, and then when you really step back and look at the big picture, there's often genetics involved.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the whole family history, and so nothing they could do or not do would make a difference. Many times a children or a child will have numerous opportunities to get sober, and each time they come out of jail or come out of a treatment center, they go right back to using or drinking.
I would say that a lot of the people that actually want to, the families that want to be in recovery and have a better perspective and work better at this loving and addict thing, and a lot of them that still have active addiction in their family, a lot of them are starting to get it because we're talking more about it. About, for instance, if their child is in jail, not bonding them out. You know, they think that that's so mean that they're not going to give them money to get out of jail. But, you know, once they understand the concept that if they do get out of jail, they could die. I mean, the trend is starting to be, you know,
yes,
thank God my son's in jail.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's kind of a sad commentary on society these days. But, you know, I hear a lot more of that these days.
Yes.
You know, at least he's safe.
And, you know, you don't know. I have some clients and many clients who recover. And then,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's always one that no matter what you say or do, they can't stay sober for a week.
Right. And really the bottom line is, you know, each one of us has our own life and we have to do what we need to do to make an impact on our own lives. But it's very difficult when you have these crises going on not to be codependent, I think.
Well, whether you're living with an addict or not, a way to de-escalate things and to stay centered within yourself is to learn to respond instead of react.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of a difficult concept for some people, but high reactivity is very typical with codependence, whether or not there's addiction going on. And
can you give us an example of the difference between responding and reacting?
Yes. So if, let's say a wife says, do you want to take me to the doctor Saturday or something?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, she's not making a statement. She's asking a question, which is typical of codependents. She's not saying, uh-huh. I'd like you to come with me. And let's say her spouse says, well, I usually go to the gym. And he's not saying yes or no either. He's not being
right.
assertive. Okay, so you have two people, and this is how conversations get derailed. And then she might react, even escalate it further, and says, oh, so I'm not important, or uh-huh. I went to you with you last time, or so she'll make some sort of you, or you never take me, or so she will escalate by blaming or attacking, and then you know the conversation at that point becomes an argument, and it's not even about the doctor's appointment.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to change that would be to say, first of all, say I'd like you to go with me,
mm-hmm.
and if he says no. Or if he says, well, I usually go to the gym, go back to that example,
mm-hmm.
to say, well, will you go with me this Saturday? You come back and ask for, it's a focus.
Mm-hmm.
You're thinking about your needs. It's problem solving.
Right.
When you react, you put your self-esteem, becomes dependent on the other person, what's going on inside of them. So she might, if he says no, she might say, well, I'm disappointed. I wish you would go with me. And so she's then being assertive and telling her feelings.
Mm-hmm.
He might change his mind at that point.
And he might not have been saying no in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So that's a simple example. And mm-hmm. it happens just two codependents trying to pick out a movie. They go back and forth, and nobody says what they want to do. And pretty soon they're in an argument about, like, who chose the last movie or whatever it might be, because neither one is willing to take a position.
I would like you to share with the audience your book, you know, your books and your website.
My website, I have two. One is DarleneLancer.com, and the other is specifically for codependency, whatiscodependency.com.
Mm-hmm.
I post regularly on my Facebook page, which is at Facebook Codependency Recovery. And I see clients. I also do coaching internationally via phone or Skype.
Mm-hmm.
And my focus is relationships and codependency. I have two books, and one will be out next week. The first is Codependency for Dummies. That's available in bookstores and online at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And there's a link on my website also.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is 10 Steps to Self-Esteem, The Ultimate Guide to Stop Self-Criticism, and that's an e-book.
And is that available on your website also?
There's a link on my website, or you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And
excellent.
The third book is How to Speak Your Mind and Set Limits, and in that one I include boundaries, how to set boundaries.
Thank you for doing what you do, and I hope people have been enlightened.
Well, thank you so much, Denise, for this opportunity.